time for today, and I think I have a duty to apologize to all of you. Can we have one meeting, honorable from Dole? It's due to logistical problems that was, logistical challenges. Because I was here in France and then directed somewhere and then somewhere, there's no taxi, so I had to go and park in Parliament and walk down just to here. So my sincere apologies. Today we have Agri-SA and we have Mr. Hans van Merwe, who is the executive director. You are welcome, sir. And we have Mr. Hendrik Ackerman, the chairperson of the policy committee. Also welcome, sir. That those are the only group that we have today. So I just welcome everybody once more for being part of this meeting. There are familiar faces that are always with us, and there are new faces as well. The issue that we are dealing with is the issue of the national minimum wage. We are seeking opinions from these different groupings that we are calling academic, business. We will go for public hearings at the end of the workshop. And then we hope that by then we will have consulted and then got other voices and their opinion at the end. So we must know that whatever you are saying, it doesn't mean that you are going to take that. We might take it, we might reject it, we might edit it, but at least no one would say that he left outside of the process. So we will then give over to Agri-SA to tell us what is that they think about the minimum wage. And you know, most companies, when they come here, they come and talk generally, you know, or tell us what happened in other countries or what happened only in Poland, and not telling us the details and what is that they think. They just come here and just reject. We welcome, we are calling you, all of you, to advise, to tell us in your own centers what do you think might be the right approach, and many, definitely by so saying, you would have taken many things into consideration. So I will give over to you after a bit.
We really appreciate and would like to thank you for the opportunity. But now you're quite convinced in the being prejudiced that you should, you just want him there to shoot me. Which of course isn't true, and you now also ask the person, send you one rifle to the vicinity of the day that we need to have. So I'm prepared to go for that as well. But we'd like to see you on the group model, so it's just in the light of the day. Thank you. Ex South Africa is a federal organization with 9 provincial and more or less 24 local organizations. According to the recent calculations, we represent about 80% of all commercial farmers in South Africa. Saying that, we are of course a very, very diverse group of farmers. If you think of the very intensive tomato, avocado, banana farming in the local province in the northern areas, right down to the very arid Peru and the South Cape, the Mediterranean area. And then from the almost tropical Natal sugarcane to the west, to the Kalahari, to the very, very arid area. And that's why we feel that you can never have a one-size-fits-all as far as the commercial farmers of this country are concerned. What is grain, or what is useful, or what is profitable in the northern areas where you have much better rainfall need not necessarily be the same with us. You all have a vision of a soccer field, a football field. Now in my area, you need 4 soccer fields to run one sheep on a continuous basis. 4 soccer fields just for one sheep. You need 21 hectares, that's 42 soccer fields to run one cow. Or ox, or cattle. For 1 year of cattle, we need 42 soccer fields. Then you get areas where you can run 42 cattle on 2 football fields. Just to get a picture of how diverse we really are. And we are not going to defend what happened in the past. It was we could never deal with that. But we must also be very, very careful about how we take on the future. As I said, we can never have a one-size-fits-all. You know, when the tax was instituted about 20 years ago, longer, 25 years ago, 56% of all the commercial farmers at that place, 56%, that's more than half, did not have to register because their gross annual income was not 500,000, which was the average couple, bottom couple. Or registering for that. So if you know if your annual turnover is not half a million, and that's a gross, then there's not much money to tax jobs. It has been over the years almost like a family concern with our workers. And I don't deny that there have been people in the past who just wrong things. But I also saw recently that even in Parliament there are people who don't behave properly. So as long as it's not the everyday run of the mill way of doing things, we must just accept that you will always have bad apples and how you treat them or how you work with them. And it happens so often that we get accused of things that are totally nonsense and almost rubbish. sun and the whole northern cap, which I regularly do, 95% of people inspected complied totally with all the restrictions. 95%. Just 2-3 minutes later, we were accused of thousands of illegal evictions taking place on a daily basis. I don't know how you get those two together. If you have 95% compliance, and then you have on the other side being accused of thousands of illegal evictions, those two just don't go together. And South Africa is a member of quite a few high-level business, trade and agricultural entities. We're a member of USA. We're a member of the World Farmers Organization, as you can see there in the notes. And then we're also members of SACAW, the parent group of our farm leaders. And then for the past 18 months or so, we're a member of ASHES, the Agri-Security Forum, where we have all, or we strive to have all commercial farmers involved in one structure so that we can have one voice talking and one voice for everything where we have from the ground to do it. As I've said, many of the farms are only surviving and they cannot take huge increases of expenses in different ways. And of course I'm the first to say why that you economize on salaries. That's the last place as far as I'm concerned where you should economize. And that's why a minimum wage is exactly that. It's a minimum wage. In my area, I don't think we have one farmer who pays just the minimum wage. Because of our relationship over years, we don't pay your people who you're so dependent on a minimum wage. Anybody who's gone to a shop recently to buy stuff, whatever, groceries, and you don't pay by card, if you actually go with cash and you count it out of your pockets, at the top, or to buy, then you realize just how very, very expensive it becomes. And that is why we are very, very pro decent wages. But we must also remember a minimum wage, as I said, is only that. That's really the bottom line. That's the entrance level for people who have very few or no skills. And it's just the case that we want to accommodate them, to give them at least some income, and to keep them busy during the day. We have been against the development, the accused of anything, child labor, and all those horrible things that we are deadly against. We reject that. We reject it as far as normality goes. We've been accused in the past of having farm schools on the property just so that you can use the children for cheap labor in the afternoon after school. And as it was sometimes accused, we took them out of the school to come to work on farms. Well, I just reject that. It may have happened in the past, but I'm quite sure it doesn't happen anymore. I'm very sure of that. And if it does happen, please bring those people's names to me. And if they are members, we will react and go with them or against them and cheat them and discipline them, that is the word to do. That's as far as the introduction is concerned. I'm not going to ask our CEO, Mr. Anton and Adler, to continue in a more detailed to almost the nitty-gritty of our presentation again, but I thank you very much.
Thank you, Lady Chair, Honourable Members of Parliament, and
the objectives is that we must get civil society's cooperation to deliver on that plan. Now, chapter 6 of the National Development Plan deals extensively with the rural and agricultural dimensions of this plan. And one of the key goals is to create 1 million additional jobs in the sector by 2030. Now, Chair, this will require a major turnaround of the current job shedding trend, which is prevalent in agriculture. In the proposals, the National Planning Commission or the plan refers specifically to using irrigation to grow some sectors, and then they also identify certain products in agriculture that are produced in a labor-intensive matter way that have growth potential in the market and also can grow job opportunities. They refer in the idea to table grapes, citrus, tropical fruits, vegetables, and these type of products. What in the plan is said as well is that for this to realize, there must be a policy environment that is supportive of the employment opportunities and the growth in the market opportunities of these products. So conducive labor market practices and also other imperatives are mentioned in that document that should be adhered to in order to achieve the objective. But it's very important to note that the Plan Commission assumed at that stage that the growth potential on a low minimum wage of 67 on today. Despite noting that they've been adjusted at over 50% the next year. So the objective of a million jobs was on the major assumptions was basically on a cheap entrance level of agriculture. Now, I've included this diagram that comes from the National Development Plan, and you see in the right top quadrant the products that they identified that meet both the challenges of high growth potential and labor intensivity. Usually sugar cane, apples, pears, bananas, potato grapes, raisins, hangers and trees, olives, grains, beacons, apples, etc. You will note that both water and cost of labor are important determinants whether it is growth opportunities. So I think the paradigm has changed already since this assumption was made by the National Planning Commission. My chair has spoken something about the background of the sector, but I need to stress again that it is a very diverse sector with farming activities ranging from very intensive labor practices. And again, if you look at the top right quadrant, that is where you will find the most intensive labor practices. Two less intensive labor practices. Vendor government can run a big farm operation with very few workers. But then we also have the well advanced technological farming systems and also the challenge of establishing new entrants into the sector, where they provide in many cases their own labor, but also hire workers in some cases. So it's a very diverse picture that we have in the sector. Now some of the sectors, and I referred for instance cane sugar, just to cut sugar, you must just basically be healthy and understand what it requires. So it's very low skills level. Or to say to harvest tomatoes. So in some cases it is really an entry-level job with a person with skills that you can hardly sell in any other sector. In many cases, such workers are also used for seasonal activities. But the trend in this sector is changing for having fewer employees but with high skills, and that eventually goes also with higher wages with complementary benefits. According to the Census of Agriculture, the number of farming units, because there's a structural change happening in the sector, the number of farming units in 1993 were estimated at almost 58,000, and it has declined in 2007 to about 40,000. We see about the rationalization of 1,000 farming units per annum at present. So the decline over that period was 32% in the number of farming units. In the same period, job opportunities declined for almost 1.1 million, so about 800,000 in 2007 is a comparable period. And that decline is about 27%. So the number of farming units has declined to just a little bit 5% than the decline in the number of opportunities, work opportunities. So with every farm that goes up into a bigger farming unit, you will have an equivalent decline in the number of employees as well. This does not imply that larger farms are always more cost effective, but rather that larger farming units have the ability to mechanize, and as wages rise, mechanization becomes more attractive. This is a general phenomenon in global agriculture, to use economies of scale. It could therefore be expected that this trend of an increase in the consolidation of farming units and high levels of mechanization will continue. This will also continue to result in a lower number of jobs, but increased employment opportunities for staff with higher skill levels, and resulting also in high levels of remuneration. This graph shows what the trend is over a long period of time, and there was in the recent past quite a knock in that trend as well. The secure determination for both farm and forestry workers governs the wages and conditions of work in the sector. According to statistics from the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries, agriculture's wage bill amounted to approximately 14.5 billion, or more just over 13% of total cost in the year of 2013-14. But what should be added to this is the social wage that includes other services such as housing, transport, water, electricity supply, that should also be factored into this wage bill. And that makes it difficult to compare with other sectors because people stay on the farm and they get these services in many cases of various quality and standard, but it is a real expense to farmers as well. And what we have witnessed as well is that if you increase the wage, minimum wage, there is adjustments in many cases to the so-called social wage as well. So there is a trade-off of some kind that also happens if you tamper with the minimum wage. And then it should also be noted that the government is now for some time considering the introduction of a statutory provident fund for farm workers. And if this isn't introduced, it can also escalate the wage bill
any other sector in the economy. Minimum wages, as you quite well know to the chair, members of this committee, have gradually increased since 2003. In a study examining the impact of the minimum wage on the sector, under Professor Warren Burat from Catholic University, he concluded that the minimum wage had a negative impact on employment and that employment declined by 70% in the first year after imposition of the minimum wage. I again refer to some of these drastic structural changes. It usually happens after some intervention, a regulatory measure of some kind. The significant increase of 32% in agriculture's minimum wage in 2013 could have a major impact on the sector. Almost 2,000 producers applied for relief thereof in terms of Section 50 of the Basic Conditions of Employment Act, the 2040 plan. Many jobs were lost. It should be noted here that this happened irrespective of favorable climatic and market conditions which prevailed for the last few years in this sector. And as we know in agriculture, this cannot be guaranteed. Climatic conditions can change. Currently, with the problem in Croatia, Europe cannot sell their produce in Russia. Europe is a major export market to us, but they now have to eat their own fruits and vegetables. And we will have a difficult 18 months ahead of us. So if you raise the minimum wage to a level that has a structural fixed element, and you have that sort of situation, I think it is something to leave in the process. So in adverse conditions, the affordability of structurally high paper may be detrimental for many farmers. And then I must mention, it does take time to bring about structural adjustments in the sector. You can talk to various producers in labor-intensive sectors of agriculture. They are planning how to adjust, say, their board practices, farming systems, to become less dependent on labor because the factor cost of labor is now higher. And some of these adjustments may take 5 years or longer before it will realize. The fact is that according to Stats SA, 73,000 job losses were recorded for the second quarter if you compare 2013 with 2014 due to, I think, mainly high minimum wage in agriculture. So this signals to the sector an issue that they must plan for and adjust to stay in business. It is therefore our view that the national minimum wage, which is set at a higher level than the agricultural determination, will aggravate these adjustments in agriculture, and it would lead to the shedding of even more local jobs. Such an intervention would probably only benefit workers already employed, but would exacerbate already high levels of unemployment, this is not only where it stops. You're most probably going to export jobs in the process, but also we were witness already that South African farmers, but others as well from other countries, are increasingly investing in neighboring countries where they have vast comparative advantages in terms of cost and quality of land, also tenure security in cases, water, both the quality and cost of water, and labor. And we have a customs union that allows basically the free flow of products. So we will most probably witness an increased substitution of local production by imports from neighboring countries. Imports of products such as the tropicals, sugar, vegetables, are most likely to narrow the opportunities of local producers and their direct, including that of their own employment capacity of our own agriculture sector. Then we are before the bulletin here. I think we have a real predicament, and I do have understanding.
No. You are done with your presentation. Thank you, Sharon. You answered the question for me. Thank you so much. There's a presentation from AfriSA members. I'll give you an opportunity to engage on it. I think we have more than enough time to, because that's the only presentation that is in front of us. First hand is from Mr. Honorable Bahrain. I can't forget her name. I only forget Mr. Toam, I won't forget him again. Bahrain, and then we have the gentleman at the top. And we have the honorable there, yourself, and the other honorable yourself, Olive, and honorable Mandasha, and yourself, in that order, honorable Bakun.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to Agri for the presentation. We appreciate it. I just wanted to ask a small question. You made the point that, in fact, the minimum wage, which your industry does have, as opposed to the other industries, not only has led to the loss of jobs, but the reality is it's been beneficial to those that have got their jobs. So it creates an elite as opposed to making more positions available in the industry. Maybe you could expand a bit on that. The second thing I did want to ask, and that appears that, and it's anecdotal because I only speak to farmers in the Western Cape, so I don't really go beyond that, but most of the farmers that I speak to in the Western Cape, what this big jump in minimum wage is doing for them, over and above the fact that most of them lost about 40% of their workforce because they couldn't afford them anymore. But they then looked very carefully at restructuring, more efficiency, productivity, mechanization, anything that would allow them to employ less staff. So in the past, many of the farmers have said that they veered away from mechanization because they knew that people were desperate for jobs. And then what flows from that is they tell us every single job means that there are 5 people living off it. So in fact, for the 72,000 jobs that StatsSA told us that we lost, you can multiply that by 5. That's how many people then would be starving and going into poverty. Thank you for that, Madam Chair.
Thank you,
Honourable
Buckley.
It's Neil Coleman from Consortium. It was interesting that the statement by the Free Market Foundation before this committee that the agricultural sector employment has declined from 2.5 million is contradicted by your input, which says that its peak, according to a graph in the overheads, was 1.8 million. Just interesting, can you explain the discrepancy between what the Free Market Foundation said and what you said? Secondly, there was a very important input by Professor Ruth Ball from UWT last week in which she rejected the idea that the change in employment in the agricultural sector was as a result of wage changes in the wage structure. The conclusion was that adjustments in farm employment have responded to many factors other than the introduction of the minimum wage. And the primary cause of long-run change underway is the product of deregulation and liberalization policies rather than wages. She then says this is evident if one periodizes the changes from 1990 to 2010, we saw job shedding overall and casualization, and from 2011 onwards, which was a reversal towards job increases and permanent employment. And it's interesting that in your graph, in your overheads, you stop the graph on employment at 2007. So what you don't show is the fact that there was a major increase in employment in 2013, up to 740,000 workers, up from 644,000 in 2011, which is very interesting. That in a couple of years, employment went up by nearly 100,000 in the sector, despite the fact that there were significant increases in the minimum wage. Now, equally, in your graph on the employment trends in the sector, you show that in 1967, at the height of apartheid, there were 1.8 million workers employed in the agricultural sector, when precisely the conditions that you were talking about were rife in agriculture, the crop system, child labor, etc., etc. And that went down to 1 million approximately by 1994. So in other words, the biggest loss in farm in agriculture was not after the democratic government came into play. The biggest loss was between 1967 and 1994, a loss of about 800,000 jobs. But there was no sectoral determination, there was no national wage set for agriculture at that stage. Now what are we talking about in terms of the elite that Mr. Bagrand was talking about, the elite of farm workers? According to Stats South Africa in 2013, the median farm worker, in other words, 50% earned above this and 50% earned below, in 2013, the median wage for farm workers was 1,733 Rand a month. 1,733 Rand a month. Half of farm workers earned below 1,733 Rand a month. And South Africa says that was for an average of 47 hours worked a week. That's quite an elite. And it's interesting that your reference to the BFAP study, which shows that workers earning about 2,400 Rand a month, in fact, earning a lot more than that, because they said if the 150 Rand a day demand was acceded to, farm workers would still not be able to give sufficient nutrition to their families. So in other words, more than half, way more than half of farm workers and their families are nutritionally deprived. So this very happy picture that you paint of contented farm workers, I would submit to AgriSA, is very, very far from the truth. So the question is to you, and also it was very interesting that the Free Market Foundation made a reference to this. They said when subsidies were removed by the democratic government, the marketing control boards, etc., etc., there was a massive collapse of agriculture. Can you honestly reflect on the extent to which other economic conditions in the sector, unrelated to wages, have an impact on the sector? And it's interesting again that Ruth Hall has, in her, Professor Ruth Hall in her presentation, has indicated that this period of consolidation and restructuring in agriculture relates to a whole lot of other factors. So it would be interesting to get your response to that, as well as the response to the trends that I've spoken about the relationship between wages and employment in the sector, which I suggest to you is very different from the picture that you painted.
Have you done this recording?
Yes,
Jefferson. A lot of the
thank you, Chair. Let us welcome the presentation. And let me start by saying, from the first presenter, because I don't know their name, but from the first presenter, he spoke of the dead errors in Parliament, which he got the example, there's nothing about it. and preparing that feeding the farm that is the agriculture. So as members of parliament, we know how to deal with our own vegetables. And we all interested to know these vegetables in the farm industry, what are they doing to our people? Maybe you can tell us more. What are they doing to our people that makes them bad? According to this presentation, it says Zimbabwe is the best place to invest for the farm. Because the wages there are very low than any farming sector in the region. All that, question will be, what are the social and political situation? How is the political situation in Zimbabwe? That is caused by the very same slavery which that was cannot compare where there's no life because if there's no life in there's no life. So if people, if you use people and they can't afford anything, they revolt. So that's what is happening in Zimbabwe. Do we want the same situation here in South Africa? Oppress people till they revolt? I don't think so. We must say 790 against 2,440 is something better. There's nothing better there. In South Africa, our farmers can afford anything with 2,440. Same as Zimbabweans can afford anything with 590. So there's no better oppressor. Oppression is just another oppression. Again, in one of the pages here, it is clear that from your own presentation, you say 2,240 cannot afford quality food for the family of two adults and two kids. That is from you. And this is a kind of a level of payment you want it to be reduced. Not even to be kept there, to be reduced. Because according to the draft, it shows the farm industry was very good. Higher apartheid, even during the apartheid. And it came down that after the democracy. So the very little that democracy has given to the farm workers, of which is not enough because they can't afford life with it. But we are saying it's now dropping the farming industry. So what are we trying to say? Do we go back to the Asian years of apartheid and keep people working for nothing and they must revolt like the Zimbabweans have done? Because the long term oppression invites serious revolution. That cannot move away from it. These people we say we are attracting from neighboring countries. They are not attracted. They are quite different. They running away from hunger, coming here, adjusting themselves to another level of hunger. Let me hold this. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Honorable Macheta. I think members should be much more honorable. If you don't know the name, you just use this company that is present. But otherwise, we're done with the problem. So it's not polite to judge, you know, their names yet we have to. program address. They certainly found us. So you call them others, and sure, they won't be offended. Thank you. Thank you, Honorable. Is Honorable Ellis back here? Yeah?
Thank you, Jefferson. I want to make 3 points. Obviously, I don't think there's anybody in this room, or there shouldn't be anybody in this room, who would want any workers in South Africa to be poor. I think that would be a terrible thing for anybody to want. I really think that would be terrible. What your graph shows a number of things on page 4 of the slides. Something which nobody has mentioned, which I think is quite encouraging, is that the only one of only three periods since 1950s that the graph is stable or improving is the period immediately after the end of apartheid. It's the only period. The graph is flat from about 1995 to about 2003. It's the only period. And I think that's encouraging, because I would have thought with all the panic around 1994 that people would have lost jobs. In terms of your presentation, I think there's two things that are clear. In your long presentation, page 5, that graph with the rand value of what minimum wages are in the various countries, quite honestly shows that most of South Africa's neighboring countries, workers must be feeling much more exploited than they are in South Africa. Quite honestly, if a national minimum wage is necessary, it's certainly necessary in places like Zimbabwe and Botswana before it's necessary in South Africa. Your figure that I do want to ask you about is the 73,000 job losses that SAFSA shows after the increase in wages last year. We had that figure presented by BUSA. When I asked the esteemed Professor Hall from UWC why she didn't show that figure in her graph, she said that she knew nothing about that figure. She didn't know where Bruce got that figure on. She'd never heard it before. And now you've got it also in your presentation, and you say that the source of that is SAFSA. Could you just confirm that's the report of SAFSA? All right. But it sounds to me that Professor Hall can't be a very good academic if she can't even read the SAFSA numbers.
No, sorry. You cannot insult the integrity of Professor Hall. It's worse when she is not here. Because now you are going for her, please. I think you must change for that.
Okay, so I withdraw that statement. But I just would like to note that she didn't know that number. Thank you.
Yes, Chef, my name is Raymond Mugunu from Food and Allied Education. When you look into it, there are some few comments that one wants to make. Of course, having an experience of living in a farm, it gives one a very, very, it is very workers are not liabilities. Workers are supposed to be an asset. So it does not take that particular, we don't get it very clear. But now, the question that one has to say, when you go to the Department of Labor, there are a number of applications that have been made by members of AgriFA in terms of being exempted. But now, on the other side, there was lots of applications in the Department of Home Affairs for them applying for the foreign workers to ship into the country. Our question is that the union is to say, how much are we going to pay those workers? Because immediately they are in this country, they are supposed to be paid the same minimum wage. And that's why we already engaged the former Minister of Home Affairs in terms of those applications that they must be nullified. It can be correct that our people here don't have work at the same time you ship in people that you want to come and pay minimum wage. That's something that we need to deal with. Yes. The situation that, again, it's very much deserving to share is the question of every time when workers are talking about their rights, they're being told about the economic situation. We normally say, before 2008, when people were talking about the economic recession, workers, especially for workers, were long. Actually, we are saying they're in life recession. We'll never come out of that particular setup. And a month of
doing to ensure that they still up their labor force.
that characterization is not attractive to the students to be. And this student is victimized for ages and ages. For the time, I don't know. What is the input? What is the contribution of RBSA in killing their workers? To stop farmers from employing expatriates in the country. While they agree with us when we say we have a high level of unemployment. What difference would it make if
your voice is actually loud whenever you speak and you are discussing.
Thank you for the protection, Chief. What difference would it make if the country put the minimum wage on the table? Because foreigners, anyway, are invited to come and work for farmers of this country. Second chain, can RBSA tell us what in their own view would be an alternative to a minimum wage that is going to be set by the country so that we can close the gap between the rich and the poor? Because there isn't a single family chair that can make a living out of 2,400. Can they tell us what is the alternative in their own view to a minimum wage so that the public can be able to weigh different options? Thank you.
Thank you. And then from Kofasi.
Thank you very much, Chair, and good morning to everybody. Chair, I think the whole question about public policy and the discussion in relation to the minimum wage, my comrades have made the point on, I think, the substantive details, as have some of the other interventions in the presentations earlier. But I think the Western Cape, we particularly alive to the fact that this province exploded in protest a few years ago. Now, the papers from everybody say that this is not a well-organized sector. This is clearly not unions who initiate the protest. The protest was initiated out of the desperate circumstances that people find themselves in. And that has to be something that occupies the minds of policymakers, especially government, because we have to find a way to find the balance between what is the reality in South Africa. Even when we listen to the voices today, they are those voices who historically and consistently defend the apartheid generational advantages. They don't want to see change. They'll direct it up in all kinds of language and words, but that's essentially what their input is on any question. And then there's the voice of the desperate workers out there who can't continue living under the circumstances that they do, and they ask for their government to find a way to address that. And not to find a way to address that in relation to what may be happening in other countries, but what's happening in their country. The elites are not the workers who are earning 1,700 rand a month. The elites are those who live in the farmhouses and those who live here in the shadows of Table Mountain in Cape Town and those who come into houses like this to try and defend those privileges at the cost of our people. So that's what the public policy must speak to. But the reality is, Chair, that there's a historical hostility that we've never dealt with in this country. And the historical hostility is what had happened before apartheid. And so we see with the introduction of the Land Tenure Act that nearly 1.5 million people have been forced off of farmland where they lived for generations and for decades. Forced off by farmers. We've seen that when there's ever any talk about wage increases, the huge outcry from farmers in their attempts to block that. And when we look at the move from 69 rand to 105, many of the farmers continued merrily as they had before, with a few applications for exemption, most of those being turned down because there were not a justification for that. So clearly, wage increases could have been afforded. So those who stand here today and say that nobody wants to see workers who are poor, well, their voices were quiet when those workers were saying our circumstances are desperate, and instead they spoke in defense of farmers. So, Chair, what we must be doing is to find a way
to undo those desperate circumstances that exist. Otherwise, we'll see that historical hostility showing itself in different ways with threats of job losses and all kinds of talk. The Minister Quincy has announced the fact that we've got to look at different models for land reform. We've seen huge amounts of evictions across the country because of the attempts of farmers to avoid the fact that they may have to share the country from those who the land was stolen from. And that's what our public policy discussions must focus on. But we must look at how we're able to address those things in a meaningful way that brings about the opportunity to address what the problems are here. And the problems are, as the President confirmed in his State of the Nation address, the levels of unemployment, the levels of poverty, but most importantly, the huge levels of inequality that has been growing since 1994, and that often is the cornerstone for the growing protests that we see across the country. The Chair, while there are those in the room who, out of necessity and out of the fact that it's just their nature, will come here and defend the apartheid advantages, remember that as a government, the responsibility is to put us on a path that brings our people together, that treats them fairly and treats them equally, and undoes the legacy and the horrible consequences of apartheid. And the minimum wage is an important part of that discussion. We've got to ensure both of the sense of how it reaffirms the value system that we as South Africans, progressive South Africans, hold dearly, but also how an essential component of this country going forward, that we're able to find each other in a much better way and not just continue to repeat those stories that are trying to defend our religion. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Patias. And we have another conversation.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, when the presentation started, I got a bit worried about the language used. I was not sure whether I was in the right meeting. When the presenter was talking about practice and method, that is not an acceptable language to us as people who are presenting to. The second area I want to allude to is they are reflecting on page 4 that there's a result where they have lower number of jobs but increased employment for staff with higher skill levels. How do they balance the requirement for higher skills with the current remuneration? Because there should be a balance. If you require higher skills, you can't expect people to apply their skills with the current wage, which is not a living wage according to popular view. One other thing is, despite all the challenges that are facing, we all focus on retaining jobs. What is it that they are doing to ensure retaining that jobs are being retained? And also, to me, they are not coming clear on their stance on the minimum wage, because you are not sure whether they are arguing for it to remain where it is now, or they are against the actual concept as a whole. So I
definitely clarity on those
things. Thank you, Chairperson. Indeed, we appreciate the different presentation that has been done over the past few weeks, and especially by organizations that represent the employees. And we've seen different statistics and different trends on declining of farms, etc., that has been presented to us. And even the emphasis on the increment of mechanization, or possible mechanization, if wages might increase further. What becomes worrisome to me, in all the presentations, there is one important trend substantiated by said expenses. That negative trend of income and profit.
made by the individuals over this different period that they presented to us. And that's a point of concern for me. Because surely we are looking at the lifestyle of the different employees over this different difficult period as they presented to us. And we couldn't see a decline of their lifestyle or that shows or indeed show us an indication of their income or profit declining. So I think maybe we should go back and focus more on that side, because all the presentations are silent on that aspect. And indeed it will be a clear indication to us to if we go to implementation or if we consider the implementation of the minimum wage. That can also be a contributing factor whether it should be implemented or not. But all the presentations are indeed silent on that. So by being silent, it can either be the one or the other. Thank you, Shepherd.
Question. As you said, your presentation indicated two things. One being the fact that most employers or farmers cannot afford to pay 105 cents per day if I understood correctly. The other being that the 150 rand per day cannot enable a family of four, that is two adults and two kids, to buy a balanced food. Is that to you, could that be an indication that most farmers are living beyond or below poverty line? And is it then not an indication that a minimum wage is needed? Thank you.
Now I will give AfriSA an opportunity to respond to this question, the question that has been posed, and then we'll take the second round of questions. If your questions that they are answering are not answered, then another round of questions. Over to you, AfriSA.
Thank you, Chair, and honourable members for posing some questions. I will agree that you cannot talk about elitism on at present as a general truth about the income of farm workers. I must reiterate that a minimum wage should not be the general wage in the sector. It is supposed to be of the lowest skilled worker, in most cases, seasonal or temporary workers. And unfortunately, those type of skills, at least over the medium term, is substitutable or can be replaced by mechanization. So that is the sadness of the situation, is the most vulnerable people can actually be replaced the easiest, given some time to adjust. So the big challenge, Madam Chair, is how do you manage it? If the business is having competitiveness, competitive fitness challenges to sustain itself. These are the type of decisions that has to be made eventually to stay in business and still to provide jobs for those who can provide the necessary skills to the business. I didn't follow the whole argument around this Freedom Market Foundation. I think it was a number of statements made.
So that's just before you go to the other question. Are you going to another question?
Yes, I'm running through.
Okay, so just before on the question that you're answering, you are saying that if the minimum wage is introduced, then you will be forced to substitute the workers. I think when you started, you said our workers with skills cannot be marketed anyway. When you presented, that's how you put it, and then you will have to substitute them with the high skilled workers. Is it what you have said?
Yeah.
I think the way
you put this, Madam Chair, let me try to phrase it again. The minimum wage should not be the general wage in the sector. It should protect the most vulnerable entrants into the sector. And the type of skills to which it is applicable are basically people whose type of input into the farming business can be substituted by mechanization more easily. But that mechanization or technology opens up opportunities for more skilled workers in the process. Which skills can be marketed more competitively in other sectors of the economy as well, and therefore that remuneration will be more market-related with that of other sectors as well. So I think the most vulnerable people are those who really just apply the most important part of labor is the agriculture. And that's an unfortunate, vulnerable group that is protected by the minimum wage. And my own view is there is place for a minimum wage, but the target group, it shouldn't be pitched at a level to say that is now the minimum wage for the sector. It should be protect the most vulnerable group in the sector, if pitched at the right level.
I'm not sure if you understood where I was going, because you stopped me before I could go forward. These vulnerable workers, or the workers that you are referring to as non-skilled, whose skills cannot be marketed anyway. I'm using your own words as you were standing there. You are saying that what they are doing now, if the minimum wage is introduced, then the job that they are doing will be taken over by the skilled one. What is this substitution of the job that is done by the law, whatever language that you use to define those workers? I want you to tell me the substitution by mechanization, all these words that they talk to the skilled workers. Is that what you are saying? That's all what I want to hear. I'm saying the job that they're doing now, once that is introduced, then it's going to be substituted by mechanization. That's all what I need to know. I don't want you to go into details, but because I think that's what we've been told now in the day, that it will be skilled workers. Is that what you are saying?
Madam Chair, my apologies if I can get out of here. It all depends on the level at which you pitch a minimum wage. If it doesn't affect the competitiveness, the profitability of the business to be detrimental of nature, they will continue to employ low-skilled people. But if the factor cost of labor becomes relative too high, that affects the sustainability of that business, the person who runs that enterprise will have to look at what the alternatives are to make it profitable and sustainable. And to just give you one example, I've recently spoken to a wine producer using mechanized harvester. His view is that if he cannot use that mechanized harvester, he will almost give that farm away because he cannot be run profitably if he has to make use of laborers to do the harvesting by hand themselves. I had this week a call from, last week, a call from a maize seed producer. To produce seed maize, you have to pollinate basically each crop by hand of different varieties to have just a crossbreed. And he was asking me whether a hike in minimum wages will be coming into effect in this next planting season. Because he said, if that is the case, he's not going to sign his contract with the seed company. Because he cannot produce at such a level, not at a profitable level. So these are the type of challenges that on a business-to-business level farmers will have to make, depending on the level at which a minimum wage is reached. And if you mechanize, such as say a machine that costs a base part of 2 million rand, you need to have a well-trained operator. Because if something goes wrong, it does terribly wrong, it can be very costly. So you will then invest also in the training of that person and make sure he's remunerated well, because there's much effect.
Just bear with me, members. It's going to be the last question on this. I don't usually ask questions, not at all. Now, I listened to your response very carefully. Let me hear your definition of a skilled worker. I want a definition of that type of a worker that you call a skilled worker that you will use if the minimum wage is affecting your profit. Just give me the definition. What when you say a skilled worker, I've noted that you are saying if the minimum wage is affecting the profit, then you will be forced to mechanize. And as you were explaining that when you are mechanizing, it means you must buy a machine that machines of high quality that will substitute the jobs, the work that will be that are going to be done by this worker. That's my understanding. Now, just tell me the definition of these skilled workers, and tell me where they are located in your company as we speak. Because it's clear that the workers that you have now that you are referring to, those are the workers whose skills cannot be marketed anywhere. However, these are workers that you have used for years to do that particular job. And then you are saying if the minimum wage affects your profit, then you'll be forced to use the skilled workers. Where are they? And at what level those skilled workers are they going to come in? And have you calculated the money that you are paying to these workers whose skills cannot be marketed anywhere in the world? And the ones that you will bring in when you introduce mechanization?
Okay.
the technician from there.
Yeah, thank you, James. Irrespective of how simple the job is, you require a certain level of skill to do a job. You cannot cut cane or plant vegetables without guidance on how to do it. So the challenge in agriculture is always, and I think we're attending to it, is to do the necessary training as well, and it can be in job training and it can be other informal training and formal training as well. And if time did that now, I think this committee may have done it already. But if they pay a visit to any commercial farm business, they will see a lot of well-trained, well-skilled people. It was only last week, Friday, that the fruit industry also had a function celebrating basically excellent performance, and they had a farm worker of the year, as well as a farm manager of the year. People with good skills up to managerial level. So I think one shouldn't generalize looking at agriculture as if all people are unskilled, but some have basically required just simple instructions to do work. If opportunities are available, I take it that most of these people can be trained and their skills can be enhanced to do much more complicated jobs. But eventually it is not the agri-SA or a grain SA or a walker that decides what the business decision on a farm is that are challenging economic realities. So to say what the skilled worker is that he must have adequate knowledge, understanding of what is required to make productive contribution to that business at whatever level he is employed. And there are opportunities to enhance his skills so that he can contribute towards more complex tasks as well. So it's a whole ladder where you can progress if opportunities are available. The problem is that to sustain a business eventually you will have to make certain decisions about the relative cost of labor to semi-conversation or applying other technologies. And that is the detrimental thing, that if I cannot do anything about, I think it is a farmer, that say how am I going to survive in a competitive environment, and they are making the decision irrespective of what we would like them to do.
I'll allow you to respond to that question. Thank you.
Sure, it is quite true that agriculture has gone through major structural adjustments, that you cannot, and the changes in the labor market was one of them. For sure, market deregulation was another one. For sure, trade liberalization was another one. For sure, issues such as extension of security of tenure was another one. Issues that affect them, the whole of the sector. And I want to remind you of something that I've included and touched briefly upon. Although farmers were a much smaller number than farm workers, there were a steeper decline in the number of farming units than in farm workers. So it is a structural adjustment that affected percentage-wise more farmers than farm workers. So agriculture has changed substantially. I do not want to use loaded words, but we're not anymore a large-scale industry with an agrarian sort of culture. It is really a competitive world in which agriculture is functioning. The 2007, I think, what is referred to in the one graph, the end of the graph was 2010 actually. The 2007 indicated it was just a little bit before the end of the graph. And I would agree that since 2010 and 2013, there was mostly a parallel and a slight increase in the job opportunities. But as was the case in the past, with the intervention of the kind of that we had with the escalated minimum wage, it did send a signal of some kind. I know it is difficult to say how we unscramble a egg, to say isolated to one event. I will agree it is difficult, but that was a major event. And I've spoken to many farmers countrywide, and I know what happened in their mindset about it as well. To say, this is a trend, we received the signal, and if this is the signal, we better start planning to fight this reality as well. So, in my view, it is a number of issues that contribute continuously to changes, but this was one of the major things that we should recognize. Can I continue to the following one? I will agree with one of the honourable members referring that we shouldn't take Zimbabwe's case as a good example to go around. Let us leave them out of the picture. The fact of the matter is that presently, if you buy, say, bananas in South Africa, and the brand names that you would know previous to being South Africa, but they now produce in Mozambique. Information that we have is that there are already in the order of about 800 farming enterprises run by South Africans in Mozambique. It, in some sense, creating jobs in these countries also alleviates the pressure of them coming to South Africa. And I really hope and believe that, that they remunerate as well the workers in those countries well above the minimum wages that are applicable in the countries. But we are witnessing a structure of change in a free trade area where it is free to invest in another country and there's a free movement of products. And I just wanted to use official data to indicate to you that you cannot shield yourself totally from what is happening in the region. And you will see, for sure, in the future, a faster growth in some subsectors of agriculture in neighboring countries. And I think it can be at the cost of South African investment. And we may see more imports coming from those countries. So I think this is a reality. I do not want to take us down anyway to those levels. I think those workers are in a detrimental situation. So that's not what the reason why I presented the reality to you. Just the case is we live in a region with open borders and such changes are taking place and we should be cognizant. I think the following contribution was also that we do not want to have poor people, and for sure my open belief is that the minimum wage is the minimum wage and the average wage together with the social wage in agriculture is much higher than the 2,400 that is currently applicable. Person on the phone that alluded to also to a poverty wage. I think I touched upon it. And we said, how can we reconcile foreign worker firmness, and how we deal with them? It's a reality that a large number of Zimbabweans are in the country, and I do not have the figures. But it seems to me in many debates, agriculture is pointed at as being the big employer of them. I'm not sure whether that is the case. I think they are employed in the building industry and in many other service providing sectors of the economy as well. So I think it's wrong only to point at agriculture. For sure, the regulatory regime, including that of minimum wages, are applicable to them. And I should prefer a situation where we have full employment of South Africans. That is the desirable situation. Fact of the matter is that we have a large number of foreigners already in our own economy, and how do we manage it? I think it's a bigger problem. It is not only an agricultural problem. The following comment, responsible condition for training and mechanization, practice, what is contribution, respect to skilling, expertise, what is alternative chances situation between the rich and the poor. I think we already cited here that we accept that minimum wage has a place. But if I speak on behalf of agriculture, I think the specific circumstance, and I think I alluded to it in my formal presentation, where people live and work on a farm, might be vastly different to that of people staying in Kailisha and working in the city. It's a different situation. And I think that requires a differentiated approach. And if agriculture is subjected to something totally different that doesn't take that into consideration, it can cause further structural problems in the sector. I think a colleague from COSATU made basically a political statement about historical facilities and how to deal with the stolen land,
Just before you go to the other question, and this question of I want to come back before you take an. You were going to respond to another question.
What is the alternative?
Okay, now just before that one, on the question that you have answered. You are referring to different conditions under which workers or your workers are working, because you counted your wood, your accommodation, water, and that those people are residing in your own premises. So there's something that was mentioned. I'm not saying it's the truth. You are the only people who can dispute or confirm it, that there are workers who are paying for the wood in the farm, and I assume that the speaker would not raise that issue if he was not referring to your own workers. Now, the workers who are staying, the farm workers in your own area, what kind of accommodation do you provide? For instance, at this point, I mean, there's a definition of a basic care. Accommodation, and now you talk about water, tell about the water that you are providing to them, are they paying, if they are paying, how much are you taking from their salary, is it something that is applicable to all your workers in the country, or in certain areas you have workers who stay under really appalling conditions. Maybe you can make an exciting example of the workers in the Western Cape and Limpopo, and just tell us if the type of accommodation, what you provide to them, and on top of the salary that you give to them.
Thank you, Chair. I think, broadly speaking, 50% of the minimum wage about can be deducted for these type of services, not more than that. I think it's stipulated in the sectoral determination. And again, you will find that it differs between farmer and farmer, depending on historical arrangements and specific circumstances on a farm. So, again, to generalize about it, I think it will be dangerous. But the sectoral determination is clear about what you can deduct and what percentage of the cash wage can be deducted. Fact of the matter is that living on a farm and having access to a number of things on the farm, and in many cases you can participate in some form of farming and grazing rights and then other benefits as well, also supplement income. Again, it differs from farm to farm and from region to region. If you will allow me just to make a side remark, I cannot vouch that we should be happy about the houses or the housing arrangements of all farmers, but I'm quite proud about me that you can go and look at that yourself. I was some time ago, and I will not mention the type of business, with a friend, he's a senior executive, who had the chauffeur business picking him up at the airport, and it was late at night, and he said to the guy, it's time for you to go to bed, I love very right, leave me the car, I'll drop you at your home. And then he drove into a shanty town and said it was the most appalling conditions that those people are living in. Although the guy had a neat white shirt and a jacket and tie, and he thought he was looking very professional and well looked after. This guy was living in a terrible shanty house. So, again, agriculture is very visible. You can link the farmer with the farm worker. But there are so many employers in this country who do not know where their employees live at night, and they are not identified and linked to that specific business. And that is for me a cause of concern. Not that we say we are happy about everything in agriculture, and that we do not have to strive for high standards, but we are visibly in the eye of everyone to observe the cause of that link on the farm. And I think we need, as South Africans, to be honest about it and say, let us have a broader and a deeper view about the needs of these issues. So, generally speaking, Chair, I think one of the issues that we are pursuing is on-farm investments can contribute to quality housing and living conditions. But I think the off-farm options and farm village options are also, I think, options that should be pursued, where people can really have long-term family security as well and proudly invest in dwellings of their own. And the whole issue of how to transfer homes and properties that are currently being rented from local authorities or provincial authorities to people to really capacitate them and give them some property. I think it's an issue that must be pursued with much more vigilance, and agriculture has its own place.
Thank you very much. I think I'm clarified, because I was worried if I listened to where you were speaking and saying these work, there are certain things, because this question of certain things that must be taken into consideration, it has been coming, you know, now and again in your presentation. That's why then I really wanted, and when we were talking about it, you were talking about the workers in agriculture, not certain workers. But now in your clarification, I think I understand, because any other person when listening to you will think that that is the norm, that you know, you take into consideration water, because if you are going to talk about water, then we'll take into we'll take it for granted that you talk about running tap water, hot water, you know, all that, accommodation, is it a standard accommodation? Anybody, if you make this presentation, let's say you'll go and make it in Zimbabwe, they will think that their conditions under which they stay, that is Zimbabwean farmers, are much more different than South Africans. Yes, you may find that they are better, or some are better there, some are the same, some are worse in South Africa. So that's the impression that one will find when this is not unpacked. But with your response, I'm covered. So you can continue.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Jay. If we can leave this meeting with a clear answer, what is the alternative to change the structure of problems between rich and the poor, I think we will candidates for a Nobel Prize. I think we should strive towards values and norms that can bridge, I think, gaps that exist in our society. But my belief is that the best long-term solution, I know we talk about the growth rate, employment reach, growth path of the economy, but we must grow the economy, and I think the redistributive aspect thereof must be dealt with in such a way that it doesn't take us off track with aggressive growth as well, but there must be a social responsibility as well. So coming from where we are in South Africa, we cannot say government do not have the role to intervene on behalf of the poor. At the same time, we must enhance growth opportunities so that there is more to share. So I think it's a big challenge, but I think it's almost out of the ambit of this discussion to solve that problem in a proper fashion. Yeah. I don't know whether you want to throw back, but I think it's a big elephant that I think you're not going to eat it today. There was a remark about desperate workers, historical. I think the government has alluded to it. I think my previous comments covers that. Honorable Montage, page 4, lower number of jobs. How do you balance requirement by skills with low wages? I think in the initial interaction on the first question said, I believe we covered that question. Advocate people would you like us to
The starting of concept ask the question, are you happy with what is
I think you approached it eventually with my first response.
I to get from here, you take the another dimension.
Okay, I'm able to have been able to read the mind about it. Meaning that you can pass.
Thank you, Chair. Here then, Honorable von Schalkwijk referred the idea to people not having a fancy lifestyle whilst he is concerned about minimum wages. So I then want to refer you to a statistic that I just put to you, and that is that about 1,000 farmers leave the sector annually for a long period. And that is mainly due to economic hardship. That they cannot emissions by blocking them into a bigger farming system to achieve economies of scale with the buying of inputs or packaging or distribution. So what we are also seeing is that some of the farming businesses, which are alluded to as my livestock, are really big businesses already. And again, it's in the eye of anyone to say, well, this is a farm and a farmer, and I think one of the participants said they live in other places of Cape Town as well. But there is an increasing skewness developing in agriculture of a smaller number of real big enterprises that is contributing to the major part of production in the country. So that is that's the reality that we're witnessing for a period of time. The models of profit sharing or participation, I think, is presently a point of serious debate, also with the land, rural development and land reform ministry. We are cognizant of government objectives that in a democracy you will have to have broader participation and ownership as profit sharing. But again, the modeling around it is basically an issue that is very dependent on the structure of a specific business and the approach of the role players, including the workers in such a business. So I cannot give a general response to it, apart from saying it is that the farmers are also leading, and it is bigger businesses that is basically in the eye of the consumer or the worker that we're seeing as a result of these structural changes.
Okay, that's it for the response to other questions. Never than just the tea outside, so you are feel free to take a cup of tea or come back. Because before your comfort break, I want us to finish with this first round of questions. Now, say, just tell me, What is the definition of economic hardship that you are referring to that led to a large number of farmers to leave the agriculture, and how are you affected by that? What circumstances that I think this economic hardship that you talk about, can you be more open and be specific? Can you tell us what is it? Yeah.
You ask I think a direct question, and I think the answer is multifaceted. If you run a business, and I think we see in the rest of the economy, be it in the fertilizer sector or in the retail sector or whatever, that bigger companies try to use economies of scale. That financial capacity and intellectual capacity and other strengths that a smaller business do not have. And being a small businessman, and I think my chairman alluded to it, is that the bulk of farmers are actually small to micro businesses in terms of the Department of Trade and Industries norms. The bulk of them are small, very small businesses. And the burden of compliance with a multitude of legislation is a problem to a person that is basically a one-man business. It becomes a bureaucratic nightmare for some of them to run their businesses. And if you have a big company, you will have the HR manager, and you will have one looking after your finances, and you will have one looking after your mechanization. And that gives the bigger farming systems an edge above the smaller guy. And eventually, if you want to leave the sector with something in your pocket, because if you sign as selling a competitive environment, you sell against a person who really specializes, as we increasingly see in commercial farming. Then the best time to pull out is when you see you still have a balance sheet that will give you something. It's not that you wait until you know that there is a what do they call it? Where they have to sell your farm because they can't pay your debts and the liquidation. So I think the best time is to say, well, I have now received the offer from this bigger farm business. I see I'm going in the wrong way. Maybe I can get a position as a manager in that bigger organization. I'd rather sell it now than continue with my business. Aspects such as drought and disasters also play their role. But I think compliance difficulties, competitiveness difficulties are the main reasons for people leaving this sector and getting absorbed by system in the economy of the process. How are we affected by it? You will see, for instance, the banking sector will not have any more in any smaller town a branch office serving agriculture. I think this colleague of mine will now have to drive a long distance to another bigger town, so they have consolidated as well their own business because the structure of agriculture has changed. Because guys like him is now driving to other places, they're not sending their children to the local schools anymore because they have to do business in a bigger town, so they leave the children in a hostel in a bigger town. And so the economic activity around the agribusinesses, the financial businesses, the schooling, everything is changing in the rural towns. So it is affecting South Africa, this reality of sustaining profitable farming systems in a very competitive environment, causing them to become bigger, extensify where they can, mechanize where they can. And job opportunities in and around towns are diminishing because of it. So it is a whole chain of things that is happening due to this reality.
Just one question, sir. Thank you so much for the explanation. The adaptive certification that not being general. I assume that this challenge that you face is it a challenge that just escalated or increased after the production of cetera, the termination, or it's a problem that we have. When you say compliance to the legislation is another challenge which is the result into the situation that you are referring to, what is that you, if you were in a position to remove certain things in this legislation that you are talking about, which things in this legislation that you think are in pertinent to farmers getting the profit? So I just want to know the specific farms that you know that they have closed down as a result of this compliance processes that you have to go through. And all the not not general, and link that to sectoral determination.
Chair, I would like my chairman of my policy comment to respond more in depth to this question. I just want to reiterate that it's difficult to unscramble this egg and pinpoint it only to labor legislation and minimum wages as such. It's a different competitive environment. I think one of the I responded to earlier question to say there are a number of interventions and market development that caused this changed environment. One of them may be the regulatory framework with respect to labor as well. And with that, I do not say, and I think I'm on record saying that which at the right level there is a role for a minimum wage to comply. There's no problem with that. But it is, if you look holistically at what is nowadays required from a business in terms of a regulating environment, it becomes very complex, and bigger organizations have a better capacity to deal with that administrative burden as such. That my colleague,
maybe not to go to open the discussion further and your response further. Just tell, I would want to know in the legislation, even if you don't pinpoint them, is the effect that you have alluded to it, that the compliance to certain legislation is a challenge. That the challenge to your profit, because if you were calling it a challenge to your profit and it leads to a number of workers losing jobs, as you are saying, what is that you, if you were or you had an opportunity to remove certain things in the legislation, what is that? Is a problem that will something that was not there. It's clear that it's something, these things that you are referring to legislation are things that were not there that made you to survive. What are those things? Which legislation exactly was? You remember that you are talking to legislators. So if some of the legislations that we make, they lead to job losses, you losing business. I didn't hear you saying that Department of Labor comes in when you see that you are in a verge of collapsing business. I didn't hear that, but it's like just so that we can assist, because some of the things, some of us, we really don't know them or not aware that they are a detriment to the business that we need in South Africa.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Agriculture in South Africa, we are price takers, not price makers. We have to accept what the world trade offers us for our produce. We're not in the position to bargain for better prices on the international market. I mean, I'm in the wool trade. If the buyers that week are prepared to pay that, that's what I have to accept. So, over time, and that's where I want to just clarify that position that I mentioned about rugby fields, it was just a way of explaining the huge areas we in the more arid parts of the country need to run our farming. In the more fertile areas, you don't need these huge areas. And then, since 1994, the decline from 67 roundabouts to 94, those were years of extreme drought in this country. people were losing farms by the day. In my area, we had about 20 farms a month that came on the market because those people just could not make ends meet because of the drought. We in South Africa get no subsidies for agriculture, and we have to compete against the world markets where people are very, very heavily subsidized. So our income is only our income. We don't get handouts from government as a subsidy to keep us going. So in that way as well, our money is only the amount that we get on the market where we sell our trade, our products. Yes, and as far as that, you know, I think because of the strain that the farmers, the agriculturalists were under, I think it is just I honestly think it's a mere coincidence that it seems to have gotten worse with the arrival of some of this legislation. It was people already teaching on the precipice, and then all of a sudden this came in, and they were managing to just make it. And then when this came, you know, say now the minimum wage or all the other requirements, they just fell by the wayside. They could not make ends meet anymore. And that was why so many farmers, and even today they are still, we are still losing, you know, commercial farmers due to not being able to survive anymore. In our area, the farms have to get bigger. We cannot intensify. So if you have to buy more land to keep going, you also have to make that sum. Because people come from outside with huge amounts of money and they're paying maximum prices for property, which you can never recover from farming. So in the end, you rather become a seller than a buyer. Just for your own sake. Just before you are, you know, before there's a sellout, you just decide yourself. And as far as that's concerned, I think the legislation, honestly, I think that was just, it just happened as a coincidence at the same time that people are on the verge of the very, very hardships because of what I've mentioned.
Chair, if I can just add, if you want a specific input on regulatory reform that can make it easier for small businesses in the farming sector, we can provide it, but I will do have to do some type of research to provide you with a specific answer. I think that your questioning, I think, a very important aspect, and that is impact assessment of certain pieces of legislation or regulations that I think should take into consideration the capacity of small business and medium-sized businesses to really comply effectively with it, and actually putting them in many cases in a disadvantage to larger enterprises in the sector. But I can be more specific, but if you allow me, I can do some after this hearing and provide some input for you on those specific questions.
Thank you so much. My question or why I seek to understand the legislation, I have a feeling that from what you are saying, if we did not introduce the Labor Relations Act, things were normal, we were fine. I don't know these legislations, because it can be that when you present, because you know, when you go to people and make presentations, people are going to ask you, is it the meaning of the words that you are using? So then, therefore, there is no, it is not advisable to come in front of people and say, this is negative, because once you say, as a result of the compliance to the legislation, that is the result. Your compliance to the legislation that you have introduced led to people losing jobs. And we are talking about introduction of minimum wage. I can't see how is it difficult for you to expand on these legislations that are negative or these compliance that are negative on your side that lead to this unfortunate situation. So you don't make statements, and when you are asked to talk on them or expand on them, and then you don't know exactly where. So that is not advisable, because I would really want to understand. I don't want to say anything that comes up, it shuts down. That's why I wanted to understand, and unfortunately I don't have anything from you, because you are not able to say this legislation, for instance, as a result of the APC, compliance to this particular legislation, it led to us closing down.
Thank you, Chief. I just want to contextualize where this debate is emanating from. We talked about the structural changes that are taking place in agriculture, and that a number of issues contributed to that. And I alluded to it may be deregulation of marketing, it may be trade centralization, it may be a number of other issues as well. But the fact of the matter is that a large number of pieces of legislation increased the regulatory or regulatory compliance burden of the sector, maybe for good reasons. I do not want to say it's not for good reasons, but you have to now be a specialist on a number of areas to really keep registers and do the proper reporting to various authorities on various pieces of legislation. One of them was the imposition of a number of pieces of labor legislation. And what I argue is that the bigger agricultural businesses have a better capacity to deal with this thing as a single small unit. And it is just reality that the farmers nowadays spend much more time in his office recording things and preparing reports for a number of reasons than was the case in the past. And this put him in a competitive disadvantage against bigger agricultural businesses. And that is one of the reasons why the bigger businesses are becoming bigger at the expense of smallers.
Any more questions to answer? No, I don't want new questions. If your question has not been answered, is there any question that has not been answered? I will open for the second round of questions. Has your question not been answered, Honorable Mortesa? What was the question?
The honorable member from AgriSA has said there are farmers who he regards as bad. So I want to know, these farmers, what are they doing for him to come to the conclusion that they are not good farmers? What are they doing to the farm workers? Thank you.
Okay.
Yes, Madam Chair. As in any organization, we always have people who do not comply with the legislation. People who are adamant that they will not do what is expected of them. And in the process, our whole farming community gets a bad name because one or two or three in an area do not comply. So if our Department of Labor in the Northern Cape say that there is 95% compliance, you still have 5% that need to be improved and to be convinced that it's only the right thing to do is to do what is expected of us. That's only, I mean, it is bad apples in inverted commas, really. People who do not comply, and what we have found is that many of these who do not comply are not members of AgriSA or any other organization. They are some of those very strong-minded, hard-headed people who think that they can still rule the roost on their property and that they will not be told what to do by anyone. And those are the people that we regard as a problem and that we work with, where we try and convince them, we get them to meetings, we invite them, ask them to visit quite a few of them. And with some pressure, we are actually changing their mind. There are people joining us now who always refused because they thought we were just a lot of people riding around the country and trying to make life difficult to pull out the farmers, which we're not. We are just trying to convince them that they must comply with the laws of the state, as we all do. And those are the same people who drive too fast in 120 km area. It's their choice, but only if they get caught and face the full heat of the law. So those are the people that I just refer to them.
Okay. Thank you so much. I'll give 5 minutes comfort break, and then we can have a second round of questions.